You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with local poet Daniel Lusk about his new collection, The Vermeer Suite. I spoke with Daniel Lusk last Tuesday in front of an audience at the South Burlington Community Library as part of their Brown Bag Lunch series. The poems in Daniel Lusk's new book, The Vermeer Suite, provide a fresh literary complement to a selection of masterpieces by 17th century Dutch painter Johannes Vermeer. Based on the work of eminent art historians and his own firsthand observations of these beloved paintings, his imaginative poetry offers admirers of Vermeer a bridge between the analysis and insights of scholars and their own direct experience that may enhance the pleasure of contemplating these intimate and timeless works. When I spoke with Daniel Lusk, I asked him to read certain selections as we presented slides of the works that he had been inspired by to write each of his poems. And I'm going to put those, actually I already have, put those paintings up on the podcast site this week so that listeners can look at them as they listen to our conversation. So right now, if you're listening to this show live and you have a computer nearby, you can go to writethebook.podbean.com if you want to have a look at the paintings that inspired each of these poems. When I spoke to Daniel Lusk, I began by thanking Naomi Miller of the South Burlington Community Library, who had introduced us to the audience. The interview begins at that point. One more time, if you're near a computer, go to the podcast site to see the paintings as you listen. I hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation with Daniel Lusk. Thank you, Naomi. Daniel Lusk is the winner of a 2016 Pushcart Prize and recipient... 2016, how does that
mm-hmm.
happen? Okay.
It just came out.
Oh, okay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Recipient of a Pablo Neruda Prize for Poetry from Nimrod International Journal and other awards. Daniel has been a resident fellow at the McDowell Colony and Yaddo, a visiting poet at Stranmillis University College, Queens in Belfast, Northern Ireland, the Frost Place in Franconia, New Hampshire. He's a senior lecturer of English emeritus at the University of Vermont. That's all from his official bio. I'll also just add that Daniel has published widely and well, and his 2014 memoir, Girls I Never Married, let us know that he's been a preacher, a sports writer, a musician, a ranch hand, as well as a poet and a college professor. His latest book is the one we're here to discuss today, The Vermeer Suite, and it's a collection of poems inspired by the works of Johannes Vermeer. Is it Johannes or Johannes?
Johannes.
Johannes.
Dutch.
So, I don't know how to pronounce Dutch, but now I know how to say Johannes. Okay, so I'm struck by how many incredible literary works have been inspired by the paintings of Vermeer, and I'm wondering how you came to write your poems.
Well, I was introduced to Vermeer by a close friend who's a painter and who has always admired Vermeer. And we were looking at some Vermeer paintings together at one point, a long time ago, and he pointed out to me the many sort of hints that Vermeer gives to, as if they were story paintings.
Mm.
And... So that sort of piqued my interest. He also gave me a print that had some pieces of Vermeer paintings in the painting. So that's where it started.
Okay. All right. We know very little about Vermeer's life, as I understand it. His paintings are known for restraint, which I didn't know. I got that from your book. I knew that he was known for an exquisite use of light. He died in poverty in his 40s.
Right.
What else can you tell us about his life?
Well, everything we know about him is from legal documents that are still archived in Amsterdam and Delft. He had a large family. He had 11 children, which means that since he was only 43 when he died, that his wife was probably pregnant all the time.
Mm.
But many of his paintings, most of them have women in them. And the suspicion is that many of those women were his daughters, and possibly his wife as well.
Okay.
He was raised in an inn that his father owned, His father was also a seller of paintings and textiles, I believe. And then when he married, he was a Calvinist. He was raised a Calvinist and married a Catholic and moved to the Catholic section of Delft. And his wife's mother also ran an inn, and they lived in that house. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have a lot of privacy, which may account for the fact that he painted only... There are only 30-some confirmed paintings by Vermeer ever. Hmm. And at one point in the early 20th century, there was a wonderful counterfeiter who began to introduce new Vermeers.
Oh, wow.
And he had some wonderful techniques for making them look 300 years old.
Oh, wow.
So by that time he had become famous, but Vermeer was virtually unknown until the 18th century. 100 years or more after he died, someone, an art historian I believe, began to recognize how different Vermeer's paintings were from the hundreds of other Dutch painters who were working. Painting was a trade. Everybody, it was a middle class culture, Holland, and everybody bought paintings. And so the market was very good. It was a very, you know, affluent culture.
Right.
And until just before he died, the market for paintings just vanished because the economy collapsed because of war. They were at war with both England and Spain for control of the seas. The Dutch East India Company had dominated trade with the Far East. And then all of a sudden, there was chaos in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why he died in poverty.
Okay.
When after he died, his wife sold a painting, traded a painting to the baker to settle a bill.
Wow.
For bread.
Oh my gosh.
So
the baker's ancestors are doing well.
I suppose.
Well, thank you. All right, that's very interesting.
I think maybe more than anybody wants, but that's the world he lived in.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the introduction to this book a number of characteristics of his work that drew you in, and I just wanted to mention them, and we can talk about them as we talk about the paintings. The subtlety of illusion, suggestion of plot, which you mentioned, the natural appearance of his subjects, and the sly suggestiveness of coded imagery. I just wanted to mention those, and then we'll talk about them later. I thought we would start with your reading a poem called Wednesday's Child, and that one... I have on this computer right here. I'm sorry it's not a large, we're going to have some large formats of some of the others, but anyway, this is Wednesday's, this is the painting, A Maid Asleep, by Johannes Vermeer, which inspired the poem Wednesday's Child by Daniel Lusk.
I might just say that the Vermeer was painting subjects that most other painters were also painting. So the lazy maid was a common subject. And so we have this one. And I might also add that you can see this sort of space behind the door there, like as if there were an empty room. In an early version of this painting, you can see from, they discovered using a radiographic, it's like x-ray. They can see what was behind in an earlier version that he painted over. There was a dog in that space. And probably Vermeer's dog, which was a spaniel, which he used in other paintings.
That's
is Wednesday's Child. I started with that little fact. No family dog, no comely guest. Now she with covered supper, bread and cheese perhaps, some fruit, half-emptied glass of wine. Withdrawn into fading light to close her eyes, unhook her linen collar in resignation, deny what went before. A door left open by whomever turned the empty chair away. Light occupies the adjacent room, an expectant mirror, blind. This is not how she began when brushing chalk paste on her face, rouge, a bold mouche, the borrowed dress, a fetching till pinned to her hair, the modest glint of pearls. Cupid has withdrawn to shadow overhead, has forfeited the scene to whatever failed to materialize. however hopefully begun, quite possibly the end of something meant to be otherwise.
Thank you so much for reading that. So Wednesday's child, I looked it up, Wednesday's child is full of woe. And I loved that you titled it that, because she's clearly, she's asleep, but she's also a little bit sad, maybe. And you mentioned Vermeer's suggestion of plot in your introduction. And I wonder, to what extent did you try to stay with his own suggestions of plot, and to what extent you felt free to follow your own plot ideas just by looking at the paintings?
Well, one of the things that I was determined to do when I started to write this, and I didn't know it was going to be a book, but this I knew it might be a series of poems, was to give the reader something based on the homework that I had done that was more than just my immediate response to the painting, mm-hmm. which anyone might do.
Right.
So that I would provide some sort of bridge between what historians have tried to guess and the immediacy of the painting itself. And I also thought if art historians were, as I began to gather from my reading, if they were largely guessing about these paintings because so little is known of Vermeer, that I could guess as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved how you guessed about this one. And you mentioned also in your introduction the subtlety of illusion. And I loved that in this poem, the mention of the turned chair, the half-open door, and this beautiful expression, the expectant mirror blind. And unfortunately, this is not a great representation of the painting, but there is a mirror back here that's dark. You can just barely tell it's a mirror and not something like a shutter or something. So that expectant mirror blind. These all seem to be examples of that subtlety of illusion that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, something's mm-hmm. happened. That chair is turned for a reason. The door is half open or half closed.
Right.
Someone's come or gone through it recently. So I loved being able to have that background as I looked at the painting and heard your, or listened to your poem just now.
She's also dressed up. That little hat, the till that's pinned to her hair, is a sort of, it's a fashion. It's a kind of hat. Hair dressing, and a mouche is a beauty mark.
Oh, I wondered. Yeah,
it's like a a false mole that's on her cheek. So she was intending, I think, company or to go someplace.
Right.
And the empty chair seemed to me to suggest that the person didn't show up.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why the ending is like it is.
Now the ending, Cupid didn't show, as you say, but on the other hand, the ending has a couple of rhymes in the final stanza, the word materialize and then the word otherwise.
Mm.
And to me, that almost offered some quiet resolution to the poem, some tiny little bit of hope for her. I don't know if that was what you intended, but I took some comfort in those rhymes.
I'm glad. Well, poetically, that was my intention, was that the poem would end.
Yeah.
It would let the reader know that this poem's over. Because it's rhymed.
Oh, okay. You're not a formalist, typically.
No.
So you just use rhyme within the rules that you create for yourself.
Well, I also like what's called near or slant rhyme.
Yes.
Where you hear echoes of the sounds of the ending words of previous lines, but they're not true rhymes. They're not ink and wink kind of rhymes. So I love those kind of sounds.
Right. Now, you didn't title the poems with the paintings' exact names. Oftentimes, you titled your poems with excerpts of the paintings' names, or once you used the same name. Your poem, Girl, for Girl with a Pearl Earring, is a haiku, which we'll talk about later. The poem, Lace, for the Lace Maker.
Mm-hmm.
Only one poem has the same name, and that is The Astronomer. And I was wondering if we could put that up, and then you could... there it is, The Astronomer. Maybe you could read that poem now?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Let me see if I can...
I love this poem.
I didn't mark them quite in order, but here we are.
Okay.
A scholar ponders the flying stars, manes and tails of comets, and whether Moses was born under Scorpio like his sister and brother. Can I start over?
Sure.
I'd like to say something before I read this poem, because you wouldn't know this. That's what's in his hand there, his right hand. His hand is on a map of the sky. It's a celestial map.
Oh, it's not a globe of the earth.
Right. And this poem has a twin that was probably also done for the person who bought the painting, who may be the person who modeled for both of the paintings. There's another painting called The Geographer, which I didn't write about because it was a very similar kind of painting. But on the wall in this painting, behind the astronomer, is in very baffling fashion, there's a part of a painting called The Finding of Moses. And, you know, that the tradition of painting biblical stories was also very much a part of the painting tradition in the Netherlands.
Okay.
And so that painting is on the wall, and I thought, how do I guess about that? And so I included it in the poem, and that's why the mention of. So I'll read it now that you know that.
Okay.
A scholar ponders the flying stars, manes and tails of comets, and whether Moses was born under Scorpio, like his sister and brother. The telescope has been invented. Now a rumor of lakes and volcanoes on the moon, that stars are clouds of smoke with nothing to say. The pole star neither rises nor sets. What sorrows lie in England and Spain? One hand on the carpet's earthly flora, one in the globe's firmament, one for equilibrium, one to point the way. He is the navigator, plotting a life with his astrolabe. Moses begins in the bulrushes, rescued from the waters as all of us are, his horoscope clenched in infant fists, his fame written in the stars. Maybe his father also sat in the dark, smoking his clay pipe, weeping for fear of the mystery. The moon tonight frowns in sorrow. We all know what word the stutterer is trying to say.
I love that. Love that. And I was so excited when I got it because Moses' brother Aaron had a speech impediment. Is that what you meant?
Actually, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
I'm so glad.
Yes.
I'm so glad to know that.
Yes, it's true.
It's just that I have a couple of friends who are stutterers.
Oh.
And all of us know, we're always inclined to finish the person's sentence because we know what they're trying to say.
I'm lying. Aaron spoke for Moses because Moses had a speech impediment.
It was Moses who had the Oh, I didn't know that. That's so brilliant.
Wow, you're so brilliant without even knowing it.
And the father sitting in the dark is actually my father.
That was a wonderful poem to read. I just enjoyed discovering that poem as I read it over and over. I kept finding something new.
I'm so glad to know that about Moses.
It's true.
It's great.
Okay.
Whose sister was also a wizard.
Oh, really?
She was a magician, too, like Aaron was.
Oh, okay. I don't know anything about Moses' sister.
Oh, I'd learned it from some old book.
Okay, great. Did you find writing about your favorite paintings easier or harder than writing about the ones that weren't your favorites? Did you notice any sort of pattern there?
I think the ones that were hardest were the ones that had the fewest clues.
Mm.
Like, we'll talk later about the girl with the red hat.
Yes.
That and the girl with the pearl earring, you know, seem to be everybody's favorites.
Mm-hmm.
They're so luminous and wonderful. There's so much beauty in those faces. What do you do with a painting like that,
mm-hmm,
when you're a poet and all you have is words and you don't want to just say what's there on the canvas?
Right. And then a couple of his subjects were odd looking. I noticed in that painting, and I wasn't actually planning to have you read this one, but The Amateur. Was that a painting or is that the name of your poem that goes along with it?
It's no, the name
painting,
of the poem.
Yeah, the painting is The Lute Player or something
right.
like that. Anyway, so not as beautiful a person, but an interesting scene holding a lute and also taken from farther back.
But the things that I learned that are in the poem about lutes, for one thing, there was a tradition among painters that, and this is one of the sort of standard clues, that if there was a stringed instrument present in the painting, it was a suggestion that there was some emotional something going on, that it was intended to suggest the resonance of feeling. But lutes are hard to keep in tune because they're catgut strings, and the wood is, they're made out of soft wood. And so it's hard to, for the lute player to keep them in tune. And so she's tuning, she's not playing the lute, she's tuning the lute. Her hand is on the keys at the top.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting thing. There's also another musical instrument in that painting. So Vermeer was just being very coy about, you know, is there a boy somewhere?
Right, okay.
So there's a boy in the poem.
I love that, because she's also staring out the window and you know, she's tuning her instrument. She's sort of like listening for it, and she's looking sort of out the distance. Okay, I'm spending too much time on a painting that we're not looking at. Could we look at Woman Reading a Letter at the Open Window, which I believe is right on top of this one.
Is that the one called Yellow?
Yellow, yes. Okay, yeah, if you wouldn't mind reading that one.
There weren't many clues in this piece, as you can see. One small thing that creates the tone of the painting is that bar across the top with the curtain hanging from it creates a sense that she's in a private space and that we're voyeurs.
Yes.
We're not invited to watch her. The other thing is I love the fact that he painted a reflection of her face in the window.
Yes.
So we were seeing her in profile, but we actually can see something of what she looks like. That letter has been read more than once. You can tell by the fact that it's crumpled.
Yeah.
And letters were, in code, were almost always had to do something to do with love, with communication between people. And the fact that there was, that the young men were often sailors coming out of Delft and Amsterdam, so they would go away for months at a time. And so I talked about the letter in the poem, Yellow. Some say yellow is for lovers. I say every day this girl clothes herself in raiment, yellow silk and midnight blue, binds up her hair to read again in yellow light at end of day his letter, crumpled now, for he is far away this too long time. The shining yellow curtain that reflects the twilight lends some privacy or even holiness. But see how the russet drape over and darkly behind the window frames her ghosted face and white cotton chemise as if we see inside. The wan sadness, barely evident around her eyes, distracts our gaze from the shadow at her nape. Does she move her lips to keep the words palpable on her breath? He says his skin is turning brown from eating figs. It is a joke. What if love is easy there? Ink begins to fade from so much reading. He was a boy with a sweet French name, the skin of his belly smooth as broth. What began as simple pleasure in their bodies ripens now the way these fruits have ripened, huddled in the bowl. She has eaten half a peach and left the better half, its pit exposed, like a votive candle for his return. Women who wait like this might bring a journey, even war, to end with their unwavering prayers. Lord knows they pay.
Thank you. I was going to ask about the crumpled letter, but you talked about it. Is that one of the things that first drew you to the story of this woman?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Did you interpret it that she was pregnant?
Well, some historians have said that the big full skirt, partly because of it's cold in the Netherlands. I camped there once in November.
Oh, wow.
And, even though I was indoors camping, it was freezing cold. So maybe just warmth, but also, you know, no birth control. His wife was pregnant probably all the time. Whether this is his wife, the painter's wife, or not, we don't know. But it's possible that it's fashion. It's possible that it's just, that's just the way it is.
Right.
Women are pregnant.
Yes. Sometimes. There are a lot of people in this poem. You start with, some say. The next, I can't remember, line or stanza says, I say. Then there's, but see, and the narrator addresses the reader, but see. So we have some and I and you, by inference, and then he and she.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to me that there were so many participants in this poem. Did you think about that as you were doing it?
I didn't so much as I was trying to set up how much I was going to imagine, trying to imagine the contents or implications of the fact that there's a letter in the painting. Being able to see her face and her profile in this painting seemed suggestive to me, almost ghostly, and a little sad. So I was trying to project a scene that wanted to be happy, but was really not. And so I made up the young man and what he might say in his letter.
Sure.
Again, taking liberties.
Yeah. Did you have a lot of false starts with your poems? Did you start writing one story and then all of a sudden perhaps another one became more bright to you or anything like that?
The way that I write, I tend to not begin until I have a first line. I make notes for, you know, days and weeks, and then see what I have written, and that I often will lift lines whole out of my notebook into the poem, and that just seemed to be. I'd read that somebody said that yellow was code for lovers.
Okay.
And so that gave me some substance, some place to begin.
And that sort of information was very important back then, you know, and I remember. I don't remember what the century was. Maybe it's a little later than this. That flowers and the importance of meaning of each type of flower was very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was love and there was, you know, mourning, and this flower meant this. Anyway,
right. That's why I felt comfortable using in the earlier poem, Wednesday's Child.
Yes.
That kind of folkloric reference, because it seemed to set the stage for the 17th century.
Oh, okay.
And what was going on then. And the fact that I was paying attention to the painting with Moses in it, in the astronomer, the telescope had just been invented not long before, around his birth, Vermeer's birth. Galileo had just discovered that a lot of the stars that we see were twin stars or smoke or something else, nebulae. And one of Vermeer's colleagues in Delft, whose name was Leeuwenhoek, invented the microscope during Vermeer's lifetime.
Oh, okay.
And so it was natural for him and everybody else to be fascinated with science was being invented. And also in the astronomer poem, the fact that I sort of guessed that the Moses painting was in there to sort of suggest that there was a bridge going on. Astrology was becoming astronomy, and science was being invented and replacing the folk tales of people's knowledge, what they thought they knew about the world.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So he was in a wonderful time to be hinting.
Yeah, wonderful. You've already been talking about some of the coded imagery that exists in these paintings. I was going to ask for examples, but is the fruit any sort of code, do you know, or for this one?
I treated it as if it were.
Yeah.
The fact that it looks, if you look at the painting very closely, that fruit looks overripe.
Yeah.
So that's why I use the word ripening in there.
Yes.
If you, it's fascinating to me that, and this is not code, it's just that all of these carpets that are in there is part of the that sense that the Dutch were gaining physical wealth. Those were all Turkish, you know, Oriental carpets. They were being brought in on the ships.
Okay.
And but if you go to Holland, as I did in the 1970s, actually, in all the public rooms, hotels and whatnot, the tables were still being covered with carpets.
Oh, really?
So the Dutch are still fond of those, even though they're old things.
The other thing I was going to ask you about, the stanza that talks about the russet drape and then the reflection of her face, you know, there was just a hint of an art lesson there when you were talking about the russet drape, and I wondered if you read art books and studied the analysis of some of his paintings and used that to word what you wrote about.
I did.
You did. Yeah.
I read everything that I could find, including a book that said just have the Vermeer on the cover. It's not about Vermeer at all, but it's a book called How to See a Painting, or How to Look at Painting, or something like that. So I, before I wrote the first poem, I read at least two books that purported to be biographies. They were really books about his life and times, mm-hmm. more about his times. There was more evidence of his family, his parents, than there was about him.
Okay, yeah.
But I borrowed everything I could grab.
Okay. All right, great. I wonder if we could look at the painting called The Little Street, and maybe you could read the poem Memoir. Thank you.
It was a summer day. No, it was all the summer days in the dog-eared picture book of memory. Brick buildings partly shuttered, blind mullioned windows, a bright alley to a scullery, a doorway to the dark. And Oma, mending with an eye on children playing, sticks and stones on the doorstep tiles. Mother at the cistern, doing household chores. Perhaps a cart has just gone by, wooden wheels trundling the bricks of the canal bridge. Mute trickle in the ditch, our own fickle past stirring behind these bricks and windows, a sense of once in Delft we may recall. But pause a moment. This is not a real street. These shutters can't. These conflated houses, these people, nobody who ever lived. Those recessive roofs, that isosceles of sky, and diphthong of passing clouds, the diminishing size of the windows, inverted triangle of receding generations. This is the architecture of remembrance. Not a portrait of the past, but a notion, fixed and enigmatic, tone without plot, no shadows, no backstory, no next. We may animate the margins outside our momentary view of, with passing barrows, a coot hen on a nest of sticks above the lapping water of the canal, the slop man's salient voice and iambic ticlop of his horse's hooves, the arch barking of a dog, or fabricate the creaking sails of a windmill at the heart of town. But the little street is mute, except for the murmur of our own receding past, which lingers like these broken roof tiles, masked by the whitewash of forgetfulness, piquant as the point of light in that far facade.
Mm, I love that one. What struck me about Memoir is that it goes from specificity to generalization. And it goes into a sort of wistfulness to me. That's how I read it. It was a summer day. No, it was all the summer days. Pause a moment. This is not a real street. To me, it felt like there was a universality of story to the way that this poem evolves. Does that ring true? Or
yes, it does. And And one of the things that I learned about by reading the art historians was, and I mentioned in the poem, the fact that if you opened those shutters, they would cover up the door. Whitewash was used to cover the kind of soil that might come from throwing slop buckets out the window into the street, or might come from it rains a lot in the Netherlands, it might come from splashing of horses' hooves, you know, in the mud. So those were the kinds of things I learned from reading. All the triangles that I mentioned, which I loved noticing in this, in terms of the design of the painting, it's just wonderful. But the windows form a triangle, the way they're stacked up and get smaller. Mm-hmm. The generations, the people, form a triangle. The rooftops and the sky form a triangle. It just had so many specifics about it,
yeah,
that I could relate to. And that point of light in the way back, in what looks like it might be a chimney face. Half of Vermeer's paintings have a pinhole in the canvas.
Oh.
As if, and then if you go to Delft, in the centrum, there are no paintings by Vermeer, but there's a demonstration of how he used light in several different ways, reflections, but also a demonstration of how he might have used string or yarn to create straight lines for the perspective of the piece. So that may be a pinhole back there.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it occurred to me as you were reading it that you were talking about the shape of the sky, which is the name of my book.
That's right. And everyone should read The Shape of the Sky.
It just made me laugh. Okay. The wordplay is just wonderful in this poem, and the stanza that begins, "Perhaps a cart has just gone by," I read that over and over, that stanza is so beautiful. Would you read that one more time, that stanza?
Get myself
the wordplay is just...
Perhaps a cart has just gone by, wooden wheels trundling the bricks of the canal bridge, mute trickle in the ditch, our own fickle past, stirring behind these bricks and windows, a sense of once in Delft, we may recall.
Yeah, you've got trickle and fickle and brick, but they're spread out so that never sounds like... You know, it never sounds like rhymes unless you start to really kind of think about it, and then you say, oh, there's a rhyme there.
Those echoes, yeah.
Echoes.
That wasn't intentional until it was intentional. I was trained as a singer, you know, I had a short career as a singer, and I love the sounds of words. Mm. And my poems they're not poems for me unless they sing.
Mm-hmm.
And so those echoes of sound were sort of, as I began to discover that I was doing that, you know, the short I sound of bridge, and as well as ditch,
mm-hmm.
And so those things were, I liked those echoes, and I liked being able to prompt a reader to hear sounds that are being made by the images of the poem, but are also being made by the language.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun to do.
Yeah. All right, so you have a poem called Holland, and the corresponding painting is The Milkmaid. I'm not meaning to rush us along, but I'd love to leave a little question time.
Okay,
sure. So if you don't mind reading Holland.
Oh, sure.
Sorry.
No, I'd love to. This is one of my favorites,
yeah,
along with The Little Street.
Yeah.
As if the day were elsewhere, as if porridge were knowledge, and the pouring of milk a sacrament. In the chancel corner of a bright kitchen, she is alone, sleeves pushed up for the task of finishing the soup or stew. Call her Holland, like pitcher and pot, ample and round, wholesome as bread and milk, a modest plenty. Her brown cheeks and hands, able for the things she has endured. See how the gleaming yellow jacket that restrains her breast is mended at the seams. Sun-blessed, the bread, too fresh to cut, the blessed milk, and overhead a basket and brass colander hang from their nails like harbingers of more. What is prayer but beatitude? A wish the troubled lands beyond, the seas fraught with battle, the town might be at peace. Others have and do, the row of Delft tiles figures at the floor suggests, her lapis blue skirt tucked up, not to reveal the warmed folds of her underskirt, but to allow coveted heat from the russet warming pot on the terracotta floor. The maid stands haloed by the whitewashed wall, its seams scumbled by the damp, pale forearms, ripe mouth, eyes downcast. She is our sister, cousin, clay, steadfast, strong. As if the shielder has painted this guarantee, her pitcher will never be empty, our bowl never quite full.
That's a great last line.
Thank you.
And I, again, loved the, some of the language play, porridge, knowledge, pouring. And then when I read that, I remembered that you have porridge in some other poems from previous collections. In Kin, in Seasonal with Goats, you treat porridge as almost sacred. As I knew that because I asked you about it the last time I interviewed you. So
it's a sort of... it's a kind of private joke, actually.
Is it?
my brother-in-law, whom I love, who lives in Ireland, the first time that I visited them, he always makes breakfast for all of us, and he likes to make oatmeal, which they call porridge. And so my wife Angela and I are both vegetarians, and so when we would come to breakfast, they would be having rashers or, you know, bacon and or sausages. And we're vegetarians, so I called it, there's a great Irish folktale having to do with the salmon of knowledge. And so I called what we were having for breakfast the porridge of knowledge. So this is
and
from actually from
a joke. And you were using it again
here. Yeah. So I couldn't resist. And also I have to say that line, those two lines at the end, the pitcher will never be empty.
So beautiful.
Our bowl never quite full. That was the first line I wrote.
Oh.
When I started this poem, I couldn't get over the fact that Vermeer painted that white line so that it looks like it's moving, but it's forever still. And it gave me that sense too that this was kind of, you know, if you think of food and bread and milk as being sort of almost sacred to us humans, so fundamental. That's why I created the sense of, you know, using the word chancel for a church, you know, a church word, a religious word.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she's wearing that head cover gave her a kind of priestly sense to me. But there's a funny thing that I just want to mention here. People always say how photographic Vermeer's paintings are. But one of the things that art historians have noticed is that there are almost no lines that you can identify. It's all light and shadow.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense of drawing in any of his paintings. But at the same time as he was sort of using an impressionist way of painting, he's also using trompe l'oeil. If you look at the wall, you'd swear those were nails and nail holes and chips in that plaster. When I was talking about the scumbled by the damp.
Yeah, I love that word,
that's
scumbled.
At the bottom by the heater.
Yeah.
Just above that, you can see that the moisture and heat have made the plaster kind of, the paint or whitewash is scumbling.
Yeah.
It's crumbling. I love that word because it sounds like crumble.
And it's an art term, right? Scumble? Is it an art term?
I don't think so.
No? Okay. I thought...
I may have made it up.
No, I think it is an art term.
Do you?
I looked it up yesterday.
Okay. Oh, good.
But I don't remember what it was.
I'm learning things. Thank goodness for your homework.
Okay. And also, you mention in your poems quite a lot of light and dark references, bright and shadow, and that does draw attention to those aspects of the work. You, mm-hmm. Did you work to find interesting different words for bright and dark?
Always.
Yeah. So in your memoir titled Girls I Never Married, which I mentioned earlier, that's where we find out that you've had a very interesting life with a lot of different careers. But you also, this is a gross oversimplification, but you make it clear, including from the title, that you have a great appreciation for women. And I think Vermeer did too. And I'm wondering if you thought about that, that parallel in your works.
I don't know whether I ever thought of it consciously.
Okay.
I was sort of interested in the fact that there were so few men in the paintings, but if he was using what, you know, who there was, then it would make sense.
Other than the astronomer, I wouldn't say that the men in his paintings are up to any good at all.
No, they all look like
they want
something from these women.
Yeah, exactly.
The music teacher.
Right.
What's he up to?
Right. Okay. This next painting that we're going to talk about, we don't have for the screen, and so I'll just put it up here. Oh, wait, let's see. Let's get back to the slideshow, actually. Oh, can I make it full? No. Sorry, hold on. There we go. And there it is. So you probably recognize this painting. She's quite famous. Okay, so this is White Fire, right?
Mm-hmm. And the painting is called Girl with the Red Hat. And it's in the National Gallery, and it's the first Vermeer original that I saw. The university gave me money to travel, which I was so grateful for, to see the originals as much as I could in New York, in Washington, and in Dublin, and in Amsterdam. And so this was the first one I saw in the National Gallery. White Fire. Scene, a hat shop in Delft on a dear, dear day. She has turned to us because we called out, captured by the flaming feathers of her hat, erupting from a corner across the shop. We recall the spark of surprise in her eye, and dimly the ellipse of a bauble idling in shadow from the lobe of her ear. The suddenly moist pout of her lips, surprised into speech. It is not we who love her, but the light, igniting a white fire of lace at her throat, or so we will swear. The voluminous folds of the borrowed jacket, ultramarine blue, framed by the lion's head finials of a fashionable chair. Did she ever exist? Or was she a bird we may fail to recognize, like the daughter of a friend, hatless on a foreign street?
I love that. Because we would fail to recognize the daughter of a friend, hatless on a foreign street.
Yes, of course. But one of the things that I want to just mention about this, too, is that if you look at what he calls, what art historians are calling finials, those lion's heads of the, it's not there, it's in front of you, the chair, the back of the chair that's right at the bottom of the painting, those lion's heads are a great example of the fact that Vermeer doesn't draw things. He's painting with light and shadow. Those are just hints of, and those finials show up in other paintings.
In a lot of his paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's as if he were using the same chairs.
Right.
Which, of course, he was.
Yeah. Did he reuse a lot of his props? Because, of course, he had
the same jackets, the yellow jackets that show up on many of the women.
Yeah.
Must have been one of his favorite props.
Yeah.
And the blue skirt may have been, you know, that's in this one.
Right. Yeah. I love to think of the artist finding costumes and finding props and finding this red hat, you know, that's so decorative, this hat. And I love that you set her in a hat shop at the beginning.
That was a real hat shop, actually.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in Delaware.
Oh, in Delaware. Not Delaware.
Provincetown. No, it's in Provincetown, Delaware.
Okay, so let's see. Okay. I wondered if you could talk, and you've mentioned that you are that you enjoy this, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about using the occasional non-formal rhyming or near rhyming in a poem, such as surprise in her eye and the light igniting a white fire. If you can just say one or two things more about what that does for a poem.
Well, it's that singing that I was referring to before, you know, that it allows the language to do things to our ears and our, it's been said, and I'm sure it's scientifically the case, that we our brains don't process imagery or sounds immediately. They sort of come in and disturb something in the brain first.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying with words to make the image both a sound image and a visual image, mm-hmm, at the same time,
mm-hmm,
which one of our great painter poets, Robert Bly, says is those are the best images, mm-hmm, are the ones that have more than one sense,
okay,
about them.
Do you think that your readers should be reading your work out loud so that they can get a fuller experience of it?
I hope they will. I'm amazed to know that, to learn some time ago that when someone was reading my first novel, that she didn't see the pictures that I was trying to paint with words. And so I realized that we all read and take in material differently.
Mm.
And we all live in a different world, in different worlds, actually, worlds of our own, sort of making, depending on how our brains and our senses work. So my hope is that people will be prompted to read them aloud because they tend to sort of do that to your brain.
Yeah.
Even if you only sub-vocalize,
yeah,
you know, you say them to yourself, they still have that same effect.
I always find it very interesting to read it on the page with my eyes and then read it out loud and see what else I find. You know, you just find so much else. I just want to finish, if I may, I'd love to read this little one because I think I probably won't do anything wrong with it. Do you want to put up Girl with a Pearl Earring? I'm sure we all know Girl with a Pearl Earring, that painting. This is Daniel's poem, which is a haiku, and I loved the reason that you wrote a haiku for this, if you wanted to just mention why.
Well, there have been so much done with this painting. You know, novels have been written about it, other people's poems have been written, the movie was made about Vermeer. There's so much, you know, public, everybody knows this painting.
Yes, right.
It's our Mona Lisa, it's the Dutch Mona Lisa, basically.
Exactly.
So I just wrote a haiku.
So a haiku typically has a syllabic structure of 5, 7, 5, and I will just read it. She was not, nor is, yet I love her then and now. Do not ask her why. I love that it's so simple. It's all one-syllable words. You didn't do any two-syllable words. No rhymes.
Right.
And no ornamental flourishes whatsoever, you know, whereas the last poem with the red hat, we had voluminous, ultramarine, fashionable, finials. All of that was in one stanza. This is just very, very simple. No rhymes. So I loved it.
Would you read it again?
I will. She was not, nor is, yet I love her then and now. Do not ask her why. Fantastic.
Thank you.
And it just matches the painting, which I think is very simple and beautiful. And anyway, so that is all of my questions for Daniel, and I wonder if you have any questions for him.
I have a question. So many of your poems seem to be linked to a visual image, a painting, a photograph. And are there other poets that inspired you to do that?
Well, I mentioned Robert Bly. Also, you know, the great, late, great Vermont poet Galway Connell was one of my first and continuing influences throughout his entire career and mine. At one point, I began to think that Galway Kinnell, when I finally met him, that he thought that I was stalking him, because I was traveling the country doing poetry workshops in schools, and he, of course, being famous, was doing readings in universities and colleges. So if he was within 100 miles of where I was working, I would show up for his reading. And I think he must have thought, who's this person? He's everywhere. And I finally introduced myself to him. But he also introduced me to the potential for using my religious background and the ecclesiastical language that comes with the Judeo-Christian tradition. His work was full of these sort of magical, old-fashioned, not always religious, but they sounded religious words. And he was also the first person who sort of helped give me permission to have the poems sing, because that's what his poems do. I mean, his great book, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, and every line of every stanza of the poem, which is a book-length poem, starts with that same line. It keeps over and over and over again. It's like a refrain, and his language is so beautiful.
Yeah.
So that's where that a lot of that permission, at least, comes from.
Any other questions?
I'd like to make a comment. It's not really a question, but when I go to a art gallery and look at paintings, I like to stand there for a long time and just see what I can get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And through this presentation, I kept thinking how enriching what you've done. Mm-hmm. It just floors me. And if I could be in a gallery and then whether on one of those earphones or a little speaker, your poem could be read as I'm looking, or anybody else. It is just enormously adding to the understanding and what I get out of that painting. It should be mandatory that would take place, because you learn so much more. If you would put back that milkmaid picture.
I think that one's up here.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that.
You know, I am here accidentally, but I felt I'm lucky that I'm here. For example, this one. When you were reading, and you know, I could see what you said about the milk and the bread and the clay pot and so on. And then you said the wall behind her is like a halo around her. And I thought, now why, how did he thought of that? That's just amazing. And you know, she's sort of like, well, a maid, a peasant woman, not a royalty. And so the halo itself, the wall with the blemishes on it, it's so fitting.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I can see that glow behind her head. Now, you know, it just added to this picture. The blue skirt, the color of that gorgeous blue just catches my eye. But now even the white wall with the blemish is just really enriching. And I would have never thought of that if I didn't hear your lines.
Yeah.
It is really, really fabulous.
Thank
what
you.
You've done.
Thank you. Yeah. I might just add, with since you mentioned this painting again, the milkmaid is iconic in the Netherlands. There are milkmaid images everywhere. They're in relief sculptures on buildings. It's almost as if the milkmaid is Holland, and that's why I chose that title,
mm-hmm.
and why there's so much about the country in this poem.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one of the things I learned by going there, by going to Amsterdam and just looking around and asking people.
It's almost like the covered bridge of Vermont.
Yes, yes,
that's right. That's right. Everybody has a covered bridge.
Yeah.
She's the covered bridge of the Netherlands.
Of the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably a good ending point. Your nice
Thank
compliment.
You so much.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
I also feel so enriched, the historical context and and looking deeper into a painting, learning to look deeper at clues for clues, not just Vermeer, but now we can go to other artists and do the same thing. So thank you both so much.
I hope you keep writing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
He probably will.
It's very likely.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Daniel Lusk. Many thanks to Naomi Miller and the South Burlington Community Library for setting this up, and to the audience members for their participation. You can learn more about Daniel Lusk's work at his website, carrigbinn.com. That's spelled CarrigBinn.com. It's a website that he shares with his wife, the poet and memoirist Angela Patton. You can also hear a previous interview with Daniel, and also two previous interviews with Angela Patton on Write the Books podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt is to click on one of the paintings on the podcast site and use that work as inspiration for a poem, a short story, a scene, or a personal reflection. Actually, it's not a link that you click on. You can just go to the podcast site to look at these paintings and then think about what you would write. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. Also by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary Lee Miller will be back in October with his next show. This is an old script, sorry. Gary will be back, I believe, on the 30th with his next show. Gary's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to WriteTheBook@gmail.com. And do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything that happens at The Radiator happens thanks to community support and volunteer work. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.